Welcome to the Accounting Web Tax Podcast with Anne Fairpo. Brought to you in association with CCH, part of Wolters Kluwer, number one in tax and accounting worldwide.
This is Anne Fairpo. Welcome to the Accounting Web Podcast for Monday, July the 30th. Various things to go through today. The summer isn't really slowing things down very much. First off, we've got revisions to CAP 1, which is getting an HMRC's advice on non-business activities. I'll go through what the changes are in some detail and why they're needed. And then an interesting case, Darra House, a reminder as to how you deal with input VAT, where there's some non-business use and the extent to which that really matters. And finally, as a sort of last major point to look at, I want to have a look at whether or not partnerships and companies are becoming an increasingly unholy mix. There have been a couple of cases recently that suggest they should be used with a little bit more care than perhaps they have been. And they'll finish with the usual roundup. So to start with the revisions to CAP 1, this is guidance on getting HMRC's advice on non-business activities. It replaces the original guidance on Code of Practice 10, COP 10, and VAT Notice 700/6 on VAT rulings. And CAP 1 sets out the circumstances in which HMRC will, or in some cases will not, provide a view on the tax effect of non-business matters. It also lists the information which needs to be provided to HMRC. There is a checklist in Annex A which should be looked at fairly closely, because if you don't provide the information requested, HMRC is very unlikely to provide you with the view that you would like them to provide. The reason for CAP 1 having been updated is the fact that HMRC can now be asked to give advance assurance on whether a proposed investment can be treated as a qualifying investment for business investment relief. Now, business investment relief is this new relief that's available to non-domiciled individuals who are paying tax in the UK on the remittance basis. Remember, this has been brought in this year with the Finance Act. For these individuals, you'll remember, normally they're going to be subject to tax in the UK if they remit income or gains which have been made overseas whilst they're UK resident. There is now this specific business investment relief for investments, business investments, unsurprisingly, made by these remittance-based users, and it allows the individual to keep the foreign income or gains outside the UK tax net, even where it's remitted to the UK, provided it's remitted to make a qualifying investment. The investment can be in the form of shares or it can be in the form of a loan, but it's got to be in a qualifying company that meets specific eligibility conditions for the relief, and the investment has to be made within 45 days of the income or gains being remitted to the UK. So it's not something where you can bring in the money and leave it sitting in a bank account whilst you decide what to do with it. You need to decide what's going to happen to it and then bring it in, not the other way around. Qualifying company for these purposes is an eligible private limited company. It must be private, doesn't apply to public company investments. They're considered, I suspect, too secure. The company must either be a trading company, a stakeholder company, or a holding company. So broadly, it's either got to be trading or have a trade attributed to it. And the investment does have to be in a company. Investments and partnerships aren't going to qualify. It's another thing where I guess things could go wrong. We'll come on to problems with companies and partnerships later. The company can be a startup, so it doesn't have to be trading immediately, but it can't be, for example, preparing carry-on research and development. The company must be operational within 2 years of the investment being made, so you can put in the money for a startup situation where there's still prep work to be going on, etc., but you've got to get the operations going within the 2 years. If the time limit isn't met, the investment ceases to qualify. It doesn't become void for all time, it just ceases to qualify at that 2 year point. Now, when something ceases to qualify in general terms, there is a kind of get out clause which allows you to dispose of the investment and take the money back offshore without being hit with a remittance basis charge. But you've got to be careful to get the dates in. And that ceasing to qualify can also apply in another situation. This is primarily where the investment produces a benefit for a relevant person. In normal terms, the investments, if you make an investment in a company, qualifying company, that company cannot produce or enable a qualifying, a corresponding benefit to be given to a relevant person, directly or indirectly. Relevant person is the usual thing, the investor or people connected with the investor. Where a benefit is made available, it's treated as an extraction of value from the company and the investment won't qualify for relief any longer. And in this case, and the same thing where the two-year time limit isn't met, the holding's got to be disposed of within 90 days of the extraction of value or the ceasing to qualify for other reasons, and the proceeds must either be reinvested in another qualifying investment or taken offshore within 45 days of receipt. There is an exception for funds which are retained in the UK to pay any capital gains on the disposal. But the problem with that is you can't just keep the money in a bank account to pay the capital gains when they turn up. You've got to pay the money across to HMRC as a tax deposit within 45 days of receiving the proceeds. So basically within 45 days of getting the proceeds when the investment ceases to qualify, you've either got to get the money offshore or it's got to be deposited with HMRC as a tax deposit on account for capital gains on that investment. There's no extraction of value by the way that the investor is paid or provided with something in the ordinary course of business on an arm's length basis. So the investor could buy something from the company, but it's got to be on the same basis as any other third party, or the investor can provide services where the technical specialist, for example, to the company and be paid a fee for those, provided it's an arm's length fee. So, say, Cap 1 is quite useful, the updates there to say that you can get this advance assurance from HMRC to say that the investment is qualifying, but do remember to make sure that you provide the information required. HMRC are quite hot on that particular note there. Moving on, input VAT. Looking in particular as a result of this DARA case at duality of purpose and what does and doesn't count as a duality of purpose. If you remember, there is this sort of basic principle that VAT is only recoverable where goods and services purchased are acquired for the purposes of business. Section 24 of the VAT Act does allow an apportionment of these expenses for VAT purposes where one proportion of them is referable to a business purpose, but there is also a non-business purpose. That amount which is referable to the business purpose can be treated as is input VAT in the usual way, and you apportion the expenditure between the two elements. Where the non-business purpose is considered to be insignificant, you can actually disregard it as well. HMRC tend to take a pretty cautious view of this where the person controlling the business has some association with the goods or services acquired. And what happened in the Darra House Limited case, is that the company carried on business at a property that was owned and occupied by the controlling director. And the company claimed input VAT on the maintenance of a burglar alarm system at that property. So, the director's dwelling. It's a fairly sophisticated system and incorporated telephone line, but the reason it had been installed was that it was a condition of the business insurance policy. The insurers had imposed the requirement on this. HMRC said, well, not particularly happy with the claim for input VAT for the whole amount. They were prepared to allow 50% on the basis of mixed private and business use under Section 24. But interestingly, in this case, the tribunal held that it was actually a wholly business expenditure, even though the property was also the home of the director who'd benefit in a personal capacity from the increased security. In this case, because the requirement was that of the insurers, the director on his own account wouldn't have gone for anything like as sophisticated as a system, the personal benefit was held to be incidental and didn't change the business nature of the whole cost. So worth remembering, just because HMRC are taking a cautious view of things, just principally because there's a director involved, it's worth considering whether that's actually appropriate or whether the non-business use is really incidental and HMRC are perhaps overreacting to the fact that there is a director involved here. In some cases, they don't necessarily overreact on directors quite as much, and coming on here to this issue with partnerships and companies and whether they're a bit of an unholy mix. I've had a couple of cases recently that look at the problems that can arise where you've got companies and partnerships involved together. Two very different cases, but they do really illustrate that some thought perhaps ought to go into what really goes on. The first case up is Hordewheel. It's a farm partnership. And the case was around annual investment allowances. The case actually confirms that you can't get an annual investment allowance for a partnership unless all of the partners are individuals. Specific ruling that says it's not available for partnerships, mixed partnerships, or partnerships with companies in. The general view is it's all far too difficult to figure out what proportion of the annual investment allowance to allow the company, because the company, of course, is entitled to its own annual investment allowance in this way. In this particular case, what had happened is we had a partnership running a farm, and there was also a company. The two partners were directors of the company as well. And they had argued that the corporate partner had been dormant for quite some time and had never actually been involved in partnership trading activities. It didn't have a share in the profits and losses of the partnership. And in fact, it wasn't really a partner. It was only a part owner of the land and buildings, and it had been shown as a partner on the partnership return because the bank required the land and buildings to be shown on the partnership balance sheet. And the company was part owner of that land and buildings. Difficulty on this one was the evidence showed that the company had actually claimed some of the trading losses of the partnership and that it had remained a partner even after it had done so, although it no longer continued to participate in the business profits. And the business accounts showed the company as having a partnership capital account, so the evidence there really didn't help. But the kicker on this was that the tribunal wasn't convinced that the company could be treated as a separate entity with no interest in the farm partnership, given that the two directors of the company were also the other two partners of the partnership. It was all a bit too close. So in part of the takeaway on this one, obviously, is the point, if you've got a company in a partnership, don't expect to be able to get annual investment allowances for the partnership business. But also, even if the company was to be dormant, if the tribunal had taken the point about it not actually taking part in the partnership, the close connection between the directors of the company and the partners in the partnership, i.e. the same people, can't get much closer than that, meant that there was a significant problem there and that the two couldn't be separated. And the same thing came up in the second case, which was Cooper and Others Leaside Timber and Builders Merchants Limited. It's also involved partnership and a company, although in this case the company wasn't actually a member of the partnership. There were four partners in the partnership. Two of them were directors of the company. They were the only two directors of the company. And the other two partners were family members of one of the directors. So all connected in a sort of family connection altogether. The partnership, and it was never really fully explained why it had been set up this way, the partnership's only activities were the provision of administrative services to the company, and it had no other clients other than this company. The fees charged by the partnership to the company for these services included the cost of cars and car fuel provided to the partners in the partnership, or specifically provided to two of the directors, or the two directors, and the cars were available for personal use. Now, HMRC had argued that the arrangements were such that the cars and the car fuel provided to the two directors of the company as benefits of their employment or engagement with the company as office holders. And they were also provided to the other two partners, although they were not directors of the company, but it was still a benefit connected with the employment of one of the directors. And so they assessed the car benefits on the directors for income tax and for national insurance purposes. Taxpayers argued that they'd received the benefits only as partners, not by reason of their employment at the company. The difficulty was the tribunal held the cars and the car fuel had to be provided by reason of employment and be taxable as benefits in kind, because the circumstances were such that there didn't really seem to be another realistic view as to why they would have been provided. The majority of the partnership assets were the cars. Their value represented about 80% of the value of the assets of the partnership. The partnership was wholly dependent on the company, which was its sole customer. And the kicker, the partnership business itself didn't require the partners be provided with cars. There was no real reason for them to have them. Partnership's sole source of income was fees paid by the company, so in effect the company was paying for the cars this way. And it really didn't help that apparently the terms of business between the partnership and the company were found to be not on an arm's length basis. You know, on any realistic view, said the tribunal, the employment had to be one of the causes of the benefit being provided. So again, didn't really go into the detail as to why this partnership and the company had been set up. It may have been an attempt to try and provide cars, etc., outside the company, but it did backfire somewhat. So really, as with the Hordewheel case, we're looking at a very close connection between the company and the partnership, really causing issues for tax purposes. It's one of those situations where you might want to rethink structures like that, where you're not clear as to exactly why they are separate. I mean, it's perfectly legitimate to have a company associated with a partnership as something separate. I mean, profit-related pay companies back in the day, for example, perfectly good reason for having them there, and where there are plenty of employees in the company and a smaller subset of partners, then there could be good reasons for structure as well. But in these sort of cases, you do need to watch where there's, you know, a much more limited and perhaps just family company and family partnership as to what's going on. And finally, sort of quick roundup of snippets from this week, just to remind you. First off, P38S for students, note that these are going to be withdrawn once RTI, real-time information, is fully underway. Effectively, they're being withdrawn from the 6th of April 2013. And from that stage, students are going to be treated in the same way as all other employees for PAYE tax and NIC purposes, regardless of when they work for the employer. So do watch that change when it comes in. Next up, we've got yet another consultation. It's the summer, of course we've got consultation. This one's quite a fun one. It's not going to affect too many people. But if you do have clients it affects, by all means, have at it. Correspond with HMRC, let them know what you think. This is the consultation on a reduced VAT rate for cable cars, ski lifts and things like that. Basically small cable suspended transport systems. In theory, it'll apply to the Olympics cable cars, although of course it's not going to come in time to deal with them during the Olympics. Emirates Airline, as I think the cable car over the Thames is called, is still in existence this time next year. Maybe it'll be a bit different. The idea here is to bring in a reduced VAT rate of 5% for the transport of passengers by these small cable suspended transport systems. Right now, we've got a zero rate of VAT for transport of passengers in a vehicle that's capable of carrying at least 10 people. Where it carries less than 10 people, it's standard rated. So any, you know, each chair, gondola, whatever in a cable suspended system is considered to be a vehicle in its own right. You don't look at the whole system. And so each one is undoubtedly going to be carrying less than 10 persons, unless it's, you know, so you've got to have a fairly large gondola before you start being able to carry 10. And so in this case, because each of them is less than 10 people, you've got to charge standard rate VAT on transport using those. You can't reduce this to zero for small vehicles to match the ones for the larger vehicles, because EU law doesn't allow you to extend the existing zero rate in this particular circumstance. So it does, however, allow you to introduce a reduced VAT rate of not less than 5%. And so that's what the UK is proposing to do. It's bring in this 5% rate for supply of transporting people by small cable suspended transport systems. It's only going to apply where transport is the main purpose of the supply, where it's part of a wider supply. So in theme parks, you know, there are one or two theme parks, a bit like the Jorvik Centre in York, where at least they did this a couple of years ago when I was last there. They take you around the museum, in fact, on sort of a kind of chairlift idea. That's still going to be considered to be an overall charge for admission, and it won't have the reduced rate applying to it. It is very much just where there is a supply of the lift itself. So again, if you've got a ski centre, for example, that's all of that's usually bundled into the admission charge, so it's not going to apply there. It is very much things like the Cross Thames cable car. And finally, just something you may not have spotted on Accounting Web, but interesting to read. It's a nice article by Robert Lovell on practical issues on emigrating from the UK to escape capital gains tax. You might want to have a quick look at. And that's it for this week. Hope you have a good week and speak to you next time.